You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Wednesday, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And they are going insane in Washington, D.C. I don't know how to say it beyond that. The president today has finally put down his foot to stop the spread of a particularly bizarre Republican conspiracy theory. Now, if you don't watch Fox News, you probably don't know anything about this. And when somebody, you know, when your next door neighbor who does watch Fox News goes, "Yeah, but what about Fast and Furious?" You probably look at him like, "Eh? Is that, you know, some new video game? I mean, what is something that the, you know?" Well, here's the deal. Let me just explain to you this Republican conspiracy theory. If you've watched Fox News for more than a week, you know this already. Or if you've listened to some of the far fringe, particularly the Fox hosts, but the other far fringe right, hardcore right talk show hosts, you already know this conspiracy theory. But average Americans have no clue. So let me just share it with you. Here's the theory. Attorney General Holder conspired with President Obama to sell a bunch of guns to Mexico. Just seriously, I'm not making this up. The Attorney General conspired with the President of the United States to sell a bunch of guns illegally to Mexico, you know, under the radar and under, all that kind of thing. Actually, let me first tell you what the real the program was originally. What was the original name of it, Shana? That was Operation Wide Receiver. This was started in 2006 by the Bush administration, and it was basically, let's sell some guns where we know the serial numbers of these guns to low level operatives in the drug cartels, in the hopes that when they show up at the higher levels of the drug cartels, we can, you know, we can know the provenance of the guns. In other words, we know how things are, what the flow is within the crime syndicates, and we can bust these guys. It's a sting operation. Okay. So, but here's how the conspiracy is working. This is what they, and it's a sting operation that didn't work out particularly well. It didn't work out well for Bush. It didn't work out well for Obama. And they pulled the plug on it. Eric Holder pulled the plug on it. Especially after a border guard was shot using, you know, by some undocumented, apparently illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants who were using these weapons. But here's the conspiracy theory that these guys have hatched around this. That the Attorney General and the President said, how can we destroy America? How can we ship, as in put in the train cars, how can we ship white working class and poor white people off to concentration camps, FEMA camps, secret FEMA camps? How can we do this, okay? The way we do it is we sell a bunch of guns to Mexico. Stop that. Go back where it was. We sell a bunch of guns to Mexico. Let me find this here. Hang on just a second. And those, in the hopes that those guns would eventually make their way back to the United States and create such a massive gun and gang-based crime wave crisis that average Americans would start crying out, going, "Oh, look at all these guns and people killing each other. My brother-in-law just got, we gotta have gun control. Please, Mr. Obama, take away our guns." And then the Obama administration would have cover to then start confiscating everyone's guns. Here's Congressman Tim Walberg, a Republican member of Congress, laying out Fox's bizarre conspiracy theory. Here it goes.
That this thing has gone wrong, was set up to go wrong, and frankly, I believe was set up to go wrong in order to deal with Second Amendment liberties of law-abiding citizens and pushing into a perception that it was the problem of the Second Amendment as opposed to law enforcement.
You hear it, the Second Amendment?
Mr. Attorney General, your oversight of an agency, of a department.
Jesus, this is all about
of
the Second Amendment.
Individual leaders
in other words, you want to take away
department
our guns, don't you?
That have not been held accountable.
Yeah.
Well, with all due respect, and I mean this with great respect,
this is the
notion
general
that this was an operation set up to do something to impinge upon the Second Amendment rights of my fellow citizens is absurd.
So, and the Attorney General comes right out and says, are you saying that we're trying to take away people's guns? That's crazy. Okay, this conspiracy theory exists in what is essentially a bizarro parallel universe in the United States called Fox so-called News, where Fox watchers or people who are talking to Fox watchers, like politicians, all they have to do is say Fast and Furious, and suddenly all the Fox watchers instantly know that what they're actually talking about, when Daryl Issa said, oh, he's Fast and Furious, aha, he must be talking about President Obama's secret plan to disarm Americans the same way Hitler did before he started sending Jews off to Auschwitz. Only this time, the people Obama wants to send off to the secret FEMA camps are the poor and working class white people. You think I'm exaggerating? Now that you know the key to the code, check out the latest ad from a guy named Sam Wurzelbach, who once lied to President Obama, said that his name was Joe, and then further lied saying that he was a plumber. His name is actually Sam, and he wasn't a licensed plumber. But anyhow, he's running for Congress now as Joe the Plumber, and here's his new ad.
In 1911, Turkey established gun control. From 1915 to 1917, 1.5 million Armenians, unable to defend themselves, were exterminated. In 1939, Germany established gun control. From 1939 to 1945, 6 million Jews and 7 million others, unable to defend themselves, were exterminated.
I love America.
Yeah, he loves America as he's firing this rifle, you know, this repeatedly at fruit, which might be another right-wing code. Anyhow, first off, the Armenian genocide was largely committed under cover of war. In fact, almost all genocides are. And just think about that for a minute. The idea that people with guns are going to stop an army? An army? An army with tanks and machine guns and grenades and airplanes and helicopters and all the weapons of war is absurd. Even here in the United States, it's absurd. Just ask David Koresh, who had literally hundreds of weapons at his Branch Davidian compound. If Sam Wurzelbach wants to avoid a genocide anywhere, he should join Thomas Jefferson and me in calling for an end to standing armies during times of peace, because it's armies that commit genocides. Secondly, the 1938, and it was 38, not 39, the 1938 German gun control law didn't forbid Jews from owning firearms. It forbid them from trafficking in them, owning companies that manufactured or sold guns. It was part of the effort by the Nazis to purge Jews from the economic body of their country, part and parcel of other laws that forbade Jews from teaching, from the practice of law, the notice of being a Jew outside a retail establishment. Further, the German weapons law of March 18, 1938 actually made it easier for Germans to own guns. The big gun control law had been long before Hitler, 1928, and he was knocking that down. They did away with restrictions on long guns, on rifles. You didn't need a permit for it. They extended gun permits from 1 to 3 years. Germany was awash in guns throughout the 30s and 40s. American occupation soldiers after the war brought home tens of thousands of them as suicides. Again, the victims of the German Holocaust were up against the collective force of a modern military. This was not the Hatfields versus the McCoys. The German army had conquered armies in country after country across Europe. And that's what made that genocide possible.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So more on this bizarre Republican conspiracy theory and how this thing is playing out right now in the U.S. Congress right after this. Okay, let's just recap really quickly, and particularly if you just tuned in. There is this bizarre conspiracy theory that the Republicans, not even the Republicans, a small slice within the Republican Party and all of Fox News have been promoting. that Barack Obama wants to, and maybe this began with Glenn Beck. I mean, who knows? But Barack Obama wants to herd white people into FEMA concentration camps. And that in order to do that, in order to have a rationale to do that, what he's got to do is make Americans so terrified of guns that they will give up their own guns so they will be defenseless and thus have to, in a docile way, go along and get put in those concentration camps. This is the storyline. Now, first of all, it's absurd. I mean, it's absurd on a whole bunch of different levels. But you know, they believe it. They believe it. And you've got, you know, members of Congress saying this. You got Joe the Plumber running a TV ad that basically is saying this in code. So you've got that. And it's absurd. Okay, it's absurd, first of all, because if anything, this president has been, he's done nothing about gun control. I mean, I'm like, bring back the Brady Bill at least. Right? What's this guy doing with a clip that holds 30 rounds in it going after Gabby Giffords, you know? But in any case. And then secondly, you know, they're trying to say genocide is caused because people lose their guns. Well, actually, genocide pretty much, I mean, with the possible exception of the Hutu and Tutsis, is caused by armies going against people. It's not the Hatfields versus the McCoys. And all that is pretty much irrelevant because the German army, you know, to go back to Joe the Plumber's metaphor, they had conquered army after army. I mean, you know, when they went into the Warsaw Ghetto where they actually encountered resistance, the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto couldn't fight back. Not because they didn't have guns. They did. There was an uprising. Stop that. But they couldn't fight back because the army was gone. The genocide was only possible because the German army had already defeated the armies of the other countries, in this case, Poland, or in France, or in Holland. Even though the Polish and French citizens were armed, if their own army couldn't hold off the German army, how would you expect the citizens to? I mean, Samuel or Joe or whatever he wants to call himself, living in a fantasy world. Finally, there have been no efforts by the Obama administration to take away anybody's guns. They haven't touched the topic, haven't even put back into place common sense restrictions like high-capacity clips like the ones that crazy guy used in Arizona to try and kill Gabby Giffords. This is all hysterical fear-mongering. And at its core, the principal suggestion by Joe the Plumber, by this congressman, Wahlberg, what's his first name? Tim Wahlberg. All of this stuff is basically what they're saying is that our nation's first black president is planning to take away guns from white people. And that plays to the basest and most crass racist strain in American politics. It's been probably a year or so since I've told this story. I first told this story the week after it happened. And it must have been 3 years ago. My family used to have restart it, who knows, but an annual kind of family get-together at one of my brother's houses in Lansing, Michigan. And one of my other brothers he and his wife have a bunch of guns, and he's got a shooting range out in his backyard. He lives in a very rural area. And Louise and I go there to visit with the family and whatnot, and we'll very often go off, you know, with Steve and Tam and go shooting. You know, go plinking, go, you know, competitive shooting on a rifle range at targets. That's it. We don't kill things, they don't kill things, you know. It's a sport. I mean, it's more a sport than golf. What can I say? Maybe not. I don't know. But in any case, so Steve and Tammy and Louise and I and one of my nephews instead of going driving up to Steve's place, which was about an hour and a half away, we were at Stan's place. There's a shooting range near Lansing. It was about 20 minutes away. And so we said, hey, let's go over there and, you know, just, you know, take along some of Steve and Tam's guns and, you know, maybe I'll run. I wanted to rent a 357 Magnum, right? I wanted to try out a Dirty Harry gun. And so anyhow, we went to this shooting range, and we all showed our ID, and, you know, I've been through the NRA safety course and all that stuff. And I said, we'll take five boxes of ammo. Right? I identified what I wanted. The guy says, no, you can only have two. I'm like, why? He says, because we're limiting everybody to two boxes. That's it. That's all you can get. And I said, well, I'll have two. My wife will have two. And he said, you can't do that. I know you guys are together. And I said, well, why is this? And he says, because that, and he uses the N-word, because that guy in the White House wants to take away our guns. Now, this was the summer of 2009. This was just 5 months after Obama was sworn into office, 6 months after. He said, because that guy wants to take away our guns. And he literally, I mean, the shelves behind him were empty. People were streaming in to buy ammunition, and they were rationing it. Now, fast forward 3 years, and I'm talking to my brother. The same thing is happening right now. The gun shops, I mean, guns are flying off the shelves, and they're running out of ammunition because Fox News is ginning up this conspiracy theory that Eric Holder and Barack Obama with Fast and Furious are trying to take away guns.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This is the most, not only bizarre, but bizarre and racist subtext thing I have ever heard in my entire life. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I just got a note from a, you know, well, I don't want to use names on the air. But anyhow, my mom told me yesterday that Obama is going to declare martial law if he loses the election. Right? Yeah, of course. He wants to put all the white people in the FEMA camps. Don't you get it? Glenn Beck has been telling you this for years. I mean, very often in code, but hey. Code is not that hard to decode, right? Fast and Furious was all about Obama and Holder, a couple of black guys, getting together to sell a bunch of guns to a bunch of brown guys, the Mexicans, so that they would come to this country and terrorize the white people who would say, please, Mr. Obama, do something about those guns. So that Obama could round up all the guns and then, with all that gun control, he could commit a genocide. Now, genocide is when one group of people exterminate another group of people. And there's got to be a difference between the groups, right? Hutus tall, Tutsis short, or the other way around. I can never keep it straight. People have different ethnicities. People have different skin colors. People come from different areas. People speak differently, whatever it may be. And in this case, in this right-wing conspiracy theory, it's going to be, I can tell you, this gun shop, I don't know if he's the owner, but this guy who worked in the gun shop, I mean, it was pretty clear to me, based on the rant that he went into, and I said, you know, this is not true. And he says, I can show you the emails. I'm like, oh, okay. That he thought, now this was 3 years ago, this is still floating around here, that he thought that Obama and Holder were doing this as retribution against white people for 400 years of slavery. I mean, white people did kill a lot of black people. So isn't turnabout fair play? This is the logic of these guys. And frankly, I wouldn't put it past the gun dealers and the gun industry to say, hey, you know, all these people are buying all these weapons. We're going to have to just ration them. And by the way, the price just went up 20%. We did not get any kind of discount on those 40 and 45 caliber rounds I was buying back 3 years ago. Joe in Alabama. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? All this is a bunch of propaganda that the National Rifle Association put out. I'm an independent gun dealer, and people coming in my shop telling me, oh, they're going to take our guns away from us, and the ammunition is going to have these self-destruct primers in them and all this. I said, do you believe that stuff? Oh, yeah, I got an email. I said, well, I belong to an organization that has 7 lobbyists in Washington. I hadn't got any email about Mr. Obama or his administration saying anything about gun control or ammunition control.
Mm-hmm.
But what that done, they put that fear factor in them, and they bought up all the ammunition I had and couldn't get none.
Yep.
And all the suppliers were working overtime, and the price doubled.
Yep. So there you go. And you said you belong to an organization that's got 7 lobbyists in D.C. Is that an organization that represents gun dealers that's not the NRA?
That is correct. Well, I'll just go ahead and say it. I'm a member of the National Pawnbrokers Association, and most of them are conservative Republicans. But
yeah, and gun dealers.
I just can't go along with it. I see the handwriting on the wall. They got a museum, and all these people send their guns to up there, and this guy's making up the millions of dollars a year.
Yeah.
And they got more. They tell me they have more people in their phone banks calling people wanting donations than Bass Pro and Cabela's combined.
It doesn't surprise me. Well, that's very interesting. Thank you for validating my hypothesis, Joe, that this is from a business point of view a very profitable conspiracy theory. And, of course, from a political point of view, Karl Rove has just got to love this stuff. I mean, this is just like Ronald Reagan in 1980 after he was nominated to be president going down to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the 3 civil rights workers were murdered in this little town of 7,000 people, and kicking off his campaign with a speech about states' rights. We all know what that meant back in 19. Well, it still does mean back in 1980. So, Joe, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite
Appreciate
Radio.
Appreciate you. Thank you,
yeah, good talking with you. Mike in Salt Lake City. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yes, Tom. I am a progressive, as you are, and I'd like to share some notes with you about the right-wing echo machine and the Tea Party and all this birther stuff and all this stuff that they're, you know, dreaming up. The whole root, you know what their problem is, Tom? The whole root of it is this. They are bitter that Obama and Nancy Pelosi won the 2008 election. So they have to dream up of all this nonsense about the birthers, about, you know, wanting to round up white people and all that silly, baseless nonsense. I mean,
yeah.
Tom, I have quit listening to the right-wing echo machine because when you say stuff like that, that's an insult to my intelligence, and I don't want to even listen to what you got to say. If you disagree with me, that's great, but show me you know what you're talking about.
Yeah, there you go. We had a caller into the program yesterday, a very nice woman. She sounded like she was probably not quite elderly, but, you know, getting there. And she was like, don't you realize that there's going to be millions and millions of these illegals voting, and they're going to steal the election in 2012? And we got to do something. And I'm like, where'd you learn that? And she's like, I watch Fox News. They told me. And I'm like, you know, this is propaganda. They're lying to you. And she's like, no, they do real journalism, fair and balanced. I'm not making this up. I mean, this is Mike, thanks a lot for the call. We put it up on YouTube. Yeah, this is on YouTube, isn't it, Shane? You know, I'm pretty sure we put that clip up on YouTube yesterday afternoon. So Jim says, yes, it's there. YouTube.com/Tom Hartman. And, you know, remember when the White House first said, this was Anita Dunn, she was the communications director for the White House, first said Fox so-called news isn't actually news and therefore we're not going to treat them like news? Here's the clip.
I mean, the reality of it is that Fox News often operates almost as either the research arm or the communications arm of the Republican Party. And it's not ideological. I mean, obviously, there are many commentators who have conservative, liberal, centrist, and everybody understands that. What I think is fair to say about Fox, and certainly the way we view it, is that it really is more a wing of the Republican Party.
And, of course, they were walking that back really fast. I think that what they should have, because this was 3 years ago, Anita Dunn said that. And I think what they should have done is they should have stuck by their guns, and they should have said, no more Fox, no more Daily Caller, no more, you know, fill in the blank, no more of these crazy guys who are going to interrupt the president during a speech in the Rose Garden. No more. It's a propaganda machine. They're the political enemy. Sound like, you know, do it like Franklin Roosevelt. They hate me, and I welcome their hatred. I will take them on. Jeff in Midville, Utah. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, I'm just going to preface my call by saying that I am not lumping mentally ill people in with repeat offenders, but I really do think that these are two classes of people that should not have guns.
I don't disagree.
I am mentally ill myself, and I know that if I've had guns at different periods of my life, I probably would have gone on kind of a bender. And as a lot of other people owning guns, you know, I have no objection at all. So I think that there are some good middle ways.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Jeff. Appreciate the call. Michael in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Michael.
Hello, Tom. You've been covering the story for the last couple of weeks about the Paul Draper book. About
yeah.
The treason meeting at the Caucus Room restaurant.
Yes, the one where Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker got together with Frank Luntz and basically swore an oath to destroy Obama's presidency by stopping any possibility of recovery for the middle class.
Yesterday, I called Jim DeMint's office
mm-hmm.
to ask about that.
Okay.
No answers. Can I speak with your supervisor? Can I speak with your supervisor? I ended up with the office manager who stonewalled me. And
they did not deny it.
Threatened to call the Capitol Police on me.
Wow. But they didn't.
Harassing her staff.
Yeah, but she did not deny that this meeting happened and that the senator was there.
Actually, better than that. She calmed down after I called her out for threatening me.
Mm-hmm.
She took my telephone number, called me back half an hour later, and said, yes, Senator DeMint was at that meeting, but she had no other details about that.
Wow. Okay. Well,
yeah.
Robert Draper's a pretty good reporter. He's written some good books, and his new book is called Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. And he kicks off the book with this meeting. And I'm astounded that the corporate media in America just has not covered this at all, of these 14 Republicans who got together. And in fact, I think it was Pete Hoekstra? Who was it? Pete Sessions. Congressman Sessions said, we understand that, you know, the Taliban insurgency, we understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side, when dealing with Democrats. It's amazing. Michael, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is just incredible. The Republicans have actually a conspiracy to bring down the Obama presidency. Obama has no conspiracy to take away your guns. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Rick in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, man. Really, really, really like your show.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a question, hypothetical. Someone comes to set your house on fire. The fireman comes to put the fire out. Do you question the fireman like he set the fire, or do you go to the police to find out what was the original cause?
Yeah, I think you go to the police.
Right. Well, I would think that if they really want to know the bottom of this Fast and Furious, why don't they bring Bush and his attorney general out and have them sit down and testify and explain to Congress why this thing was put in place?
Yeah, because they put the program together. They called it Operation Wide Receiver, but they put that program in place. The reason that they're not doing that is the same reason that they're holding this vote to hold the president or the attorney general in contempt, and that is that this has everything to do with politics and nothing to do with reality. I mean,
it's a very simple explanation. I also want to say this. If you never saw it before, this lays out before you clean and plain, the Republican Party is racist as hell, and they would do anything to go ahead and discredit the black race or a black man or use black people in any advantage that they can to gain the upper hand.
Well, and here's the guy who's the official spokesman or the unofficial spokesman of the Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh. We've got this clip. It's clip number one. This is Limbaugh yesterday speaking right to that issue. Listen to this.
Obama's campaign wants to turn Mitt Romney into the candidate of old, straight, white men. So does that mean you should vote for Obama because he's a young, black, gay man?
So there you go. Yeah.
Well, I'm asking, what does this mean?
Whoa. I didn't realize there was more.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so sick.
Yeah.
One other question.
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Have you ever read The Fall of America written by Elijah Muhammad?
No, I've not.
It was published in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Man, but the book reads like it was written yesterday.
Wow.
Now, keep in mind, 72, the country was pretty much thriving and whatnot. Everybody was at work. Everything was going great. But he described a time where there would be no jobs for the people. He described a time where it would be many wars going on. And it lays it out simple and plain, just like we're living today.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. I sit there and I read it last month, and my jaw was just open. I could not believe it.
I will have to check that out. Rick,
yeah,
Rick,
please read that.
Yeah, I will. Thank you very much for the call. I want to get some more callers in here. I appreciate the call. Bart in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Bart, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was just wanting to mention something. You had mentioned that Obama hasn't done anything in regards to gun laws, and I was thinking, if anything, he's been kind of pro-gun, because under his administration they passed a law allowing loaded guns in national parks.
You're right. Yeah, he has actually expanded the rights of gun owners rather than contracted them. But he's also, you know, he also gave the largest tax break in the history of America to working people, and most people don't know that either. I guarantee you no Fox viewers know that.
That's a good point.
Very, very simple fact. So anyhow, thank you very much for the call.
Right.
I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Good to hear from you. JP in Warren, Michigan. Hey, JP, you disagree with me?
Yeah, the Kool-Aid cup runneth over on the Tom Hartman show.
Okay.
I'm a Tea Party member, and there's not one Tea Party member I've talked to that believes that Fast and Furious was a ploy to do in the Second Amendment. What we're concerned with is that...
Well, let me share with you a member of the United States Congress, Representative Rick Tim Walberg, who explicitly comes right out, and this is one of the guys who's investigating this, right? He's on the committee with Daryl Issa. Yeah, Daryl Issa could easily say to him, come on, Tim, are you nuts? But he didn't. Here is Congressman Tim Walberg. Now, just listen when he starts talking about how Fast and Furious is part of a conspiracy to take away our Second Amendment rights, and listen to Eric Holder's response, because now that you know the code that they're all talking in, just listen to this.
That this thing was set up to go wrong.
Set up
and
to
and
go
frankly, wrong. I believe it was set up to go wrong in order to deal with Second Amendment liberties of law-abiding citizens and pushing into a perception that it was the problem of the Second Amendment as opposed to law enforcement. And more importantly, Mr. Attorney General, your oversight of an agency, of a department, of individual leaders in that department that have not been held accountable.
Well, with all due respect, and I mean this with great respect, the notion that this was an operation set up to do something to impinge upon the Second Amendment rights of my fellow citizens is absurd.
So there you go. Your argument is not with me. It's with Congressman Tim Walberg.
What that guy said. My point is that what we're concerned about is that the federal government started a program that was canceled under the Bush administration and expanded it, and after people were killed...
Stopped it.
After people were killed, they continued it, and then they tried to cover it up.
No, they didn't continue it. They stopped it.
They stopped it after the whistleblowers alerted the Senate, and the Senate went after them.
Okay,
when
it became whatever, it's
injustice.
It's been stopped, but what's your
point?
Come on,
Tom, get it out. Come on.
Well, yeah, I just don't understand what you're trying to say. I mean, you've got this congressman. I've got 30 or 40 emails here from right-wingers who are all saying the same thing. I can point you to websites that are talking about this. You know, go over to the Blaze website. Check out some of these right-wing websites. It's all over the place. This is a conspiracy to destroy our Second Amendment rights. That's what Fast and Furious is.
That's anecdotal right-wing nuts, and I don't subscribe to them.
This is not
99% of us don't.
Once again, Congressman Tim Walberg, this is no anecdote, and this is no right-wing nut. This is a member of the United States House of Representatives and a Tea Partier. Here he is.
That this thing has gone wrong was set up to go wrong.
Set up to go wrong.
And frankly,
it was set,
I believe, was set up to go wrong in order to deal with Second Amendment liberties.
In order to take away our gun rights.
Law-abiding citizens.
From our law-abiding citizens.
And pushing into a perception.
And just
that
make
it
look
the problem
like
of the Second Amendment.
It's a problem
as opposed to law
of
enforcement.
Law enforcement.
And more importantly,
but really, and you can stop that now, Shane. But really, what it's all about is we've got to figure out a way to overturn the Second Amendment, and we got to get people to go along with it. So we're going to send a bunch of these guns down to these brown people in Mexico, so they'll come up here and create all this crime. Come on, JP. Join the rest of the world. Wake up. Watch Fox News for a week. You'll get it. this conspiracy theory, I am telling you, is no secret on the right. None. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, Thomas Jefferson, back in 1781, when he was in the Virginia House of Burgesses, keep in mind, this is the guy who started the free University of Virginia and has that on his tombstone, rather than that he was president of the United States twice. He was more proud of founding the University of Virginia. He wrote, "For the more general diffusion of knowledge, it becomes expedient for promoting the public happiness that those persons whom nature has endowed with genius and virtue should be rendered by liberal education worthy to receive and able to guard the sacred deposits of the rights and liberties of their fellow citizens, and that they should be called to that charge without regard to wealth, birth, or accidental condition or circumstance, and educated at the common expense of all." Ben Franklin, in his Proposals Relating to the Education of Youth in Pennsylvania, wrote, "The good education of youth has been esteemed by wise men of all ages as the surest foundation of the happiness of the commonwealth. Almost all governments have therefore made it a principal object of their attention to establish and endow with proper revenues such seminaries of learning as might supply the succeeding age with men qualified to serve the public with honor to themselves and to their country." So how do we do that? Stephen DeMora is with us. He's the president of Americans for Job Security, a blogger over at redstate.com, savejobs.org, their website. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You seem to be quite upset that the president, that the Obama administration, is not so kindly disposed toward for-profit educational loan sharks and for-profit educational institutions, and would rather have government fund education and, for that matter, loans necessary for education. I don't understand why.
Yeah, we're actually quite upset about the exact opposite. What we are upset about is there is a growing need, and this has been true for a long number of years, for access to higher education for all people. And with budget crunches and decreases in funding at the state level, there is increased need for access to student loans and student loan payments.
Why should we have student loans? Why not just have free education? If you agree with me that there's an increased, you know, that our most important infrastructure is our intellectual infrastructure. I mean, we all pay to build bridges. Why don't we all pay to educate our students, including our college students, like pretty much every developed country in the world does?
Well, we certainly subsidize higher education at a very significant portion.
No, but I'm asking just a simple question here. It seems to me that conservatives are only in favor of higher education when somebody can make a buck off it. And that's the subtle subtext of the flowery oratory that you're laying on me here. And I'm saying, will you instead join me and say, no, we should all tax ourselves and use that money to put anybody who can go to college through college for free so that we can, as we used to do before Ronald Reagan became president and before he became governor of California, as we used to do, so that once again we can be the country that produces the smartest scientists in the world instead of being 38th in the world in education right down there with Slovenia.
I think that the faux outrage that you are showing is really
there's nothing faux about it.
To protect the entrenched higher education interests, the millionaire college presidents, the professors at state colleges and universities who aren't teaching anyone. I think that what we need is accountability in higher education to ensure that as many people as possible have access.
You are changing the subject, and you're trying, and you're changing the subject in a way that you're trying to vilify the people that you're describing as basically some sort of an educational elite. Let me tell you, if there are college professor, or excuse me, presidents who are making millions of dollars, I'm opposed to it too. But I somehow I doubt you're opposed to the head of a for-profit college making millions. Am I right?
No. I mean,
so you don't think that Chris Whittle should be making millions of dollars?
I'm sorry, I don't know who Chris Whittle is.
He runs Education One, you know, this private educational program. There's a bunch of them. I mean, do you think that the CEO of the University of Phoenix, another for-profit college, should be making millions of dollars?
I think that the colleges and universities themselves, whether they're nonprofit or for-profit, should decide the salaries of their...
Well, just a minute ago, you were attacking these college presidents for making so much money.
No, I'm attacking them for making that much money because there's no accountability in the way that the government is spending our student dollars.
That's nonsense. The accountability is in the ballot box. If people don't like the way that it's being done, we vote in representatives who take the money away from them. But what conservatives are trying to do is take the money. I mean, we've got $1 trillion in student debt right now. I grew up in an age where I didn't finish college, but to the extent that I went to college and to two different colleges, I did it working as a DJ making $2.35 an hour. I did it pumping gas. I did it replacing tires. And I did it washing dishes at Bob's Big Boy. My wife put herself through college working as a waitress at a Howard Johnson's. You can't do that today because of this contamination of for-profit colleges. And because back then, colleges were competing with free colleges. This was before Reagan did away with free public education in California.
Your argument is completely nonsensical.
I lived through it.
The rise of for-profit education is a recent phenomenon. It does not point to the 30-year rise in college tuitions. The 30-year rise in college tuitions is
goes back to when Reagan did away with free college education.
Okay, well, states are the ones that control a majority of nonprofit colleges. The federal government doesn't run a single college. So
no, but it funds
really
them
sure
heavily, as you said a few minutes ago.
Through student loans.
No, not well, it wasn't 30 years ago. I didn't have to get a student loan to go to college, neither did my wife. And neither did anybody else I know who's my age.
Government policy. So I'm not really sure what point it is you're making.
My point is that our educational infrastructure is part of our commons. And as such, A, it should not be for profit at all. And B, we should all be paying for it so that anybody who's competent can go to college. I mean, if we want to be the strongest nation in the world intellectually,
go to college because of lack of funds.
That's my point.
That student does not exist.
I beg your pardon?
That student does not exist.
Oh yeah, there's always some loan shark willing to make you $100,000 in debt when you graduate.
Well,
I agree with that. I'm saying that's wrong.
The loan shark you're talking about is the federal government. They control 100% of the student loan industry.
And you want to change that. You want to flip it back to giving it back to the banks.
Well, I mean, even when the banks ran it, the federal government subsidized it and vouched for it.
And made a lot of money for the banks. And the banks are really pissed off at Obama for taking it away from them. I mean, they lost something like $60 billion.
You are misconstruing the point completely. The point is that there should be controls as to how this money is spent. And we cannot provide unlimited amounts of student funds because
nobody is talking about that.
You are talking about that.
I'm talking about funding colleges so that they can, so the people can go to college. My dad came back from World War II. He went to college. Not only did he go to college for free, but they paid him $100 a month, which back then was like, you know, $1,000 a month today, stipend for room and board. My wife's father went all the way through, got his JD degree, and became the assistant state attorney general for the state of Michigan. Simply, and his
is a wonderful anecdote. And we continue to do that for
the
military.
America is full of them. The GI Bill more than doubled the number of college graduates in the United States in 5 years.
Sir, we continue to do that. So I'm not. Really
we
sure.
do not. We have $1 trillion in student debt that never existed in the history of this country.
Well, you did just say that your grandfather came back from World
My
War II,
father.
Correct? Your father. Okay, came back from World War II. So I presume it was on the GI Bill that he was...
That's exactly right.
And that still exists today. The benefits still exist to those that serve our country.
But
what we're talking about is those people that take student loans from the federal government. And whether those student loans should continue to increase, those payments to private and for-profit both, should continue to increase with no strings attached. And we say that the costs need to be controlled.
It's a straw man argument. Nobody's saying no strings attached. And what I'm saying is end the student loans. Make college free. Okay, Stephen DeMora, you can read all about it at savejobs.org. Thank you, Stephen.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What's wrong with making college free? I don't get it. I think, you know, if you want to have the smartest country, educate somebody! Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Henry in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Henry, what's up?
I tell you what, Tom, sometimes I just want to run out of the building screaming, but what good would it do? Because it seems like they just don't get it. You know, the guy that you talk to and talking about education, college education, you know, they still get the same sorry talking point. They blame the pay of the teachers, blame the school superintendents and things of that nature. You know, it is crazy. Yeah. I mean, reality is in one way or the other. Would you like to have your child grow up in a classroom where there's only 15 or maybe 20 kids in it? That way the teacher be able to teach every last one of them, have a good lesson plan, and continue moving. Or do you want her in a classroom with 50 kids and she got to stop and repeat everything she say and at the end of the day had accomplished nothing?
Right. Well, what we've seen, I mean, this is not an academic question, Henry, that you're asking, because when Reagan came into office, we had the world class educational system, both in our public schools and our public institute colleges. You know, our the land grant colleges that Abraham Lincoln started as free colleges, you know, like Michigan State University and I don't know all the ones around the country, but you know, these land grant colleges. Say what they said again?
Yeah, we have vibrant community colleges as well.
As well,
and
absolutely.
You can go in there and really, you can have a part-time job, go to community college, get a good education, and get a good job.
Yep.
Now we can't do neither because it takes almost as much money to go to a community college as it does a major university.
Yep.
It is absolutely absurd.
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. And this is something that we must change. If we're going to have an educated generation rather than an indebted generation. Having a trillion? Go ahead.
If you listen to the Republicans, they want everything to be business-oriented.
Sure.
I don't care what it is. They want you to have health care like a business-oriented deal.
Yep.
They want you to, I mean, you can name it, any part of the public that used to be free, anything that used to be systems that an average working man can work for to do, everything got to have a business tag to it, and now a common working man can't afford anything.
Yeah,
world these people want you to do it on fixed income.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Jeff. And this is the bottom line for Republicans: is if you can't make a buck off it, they don't want it to happen. And if it's part of the commons, if it's something that we can all benefit from, they want to figure out a way that Mitt Romney or somebody like him can make a buck off it. Jeff, thank you very much for the call. Well said, Jay in Diamond City, Arkansas. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great, but I'll get better. How about you, Jay?
Oh, pretty good. I'm a single father of three children,
mm-hmm.
and I work 105 hours a week.
Whoa.
I work 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, and I cannot afford to send my children to college, and I absolutely agree with you that we've got to come up with a way to educate our kids.
Yeah, that's a crime that you're working that many hours and you can't put your kids through school. That's a crime. I mean, that just shouldn't happen in our society.
I was just, you know, I don't know how we could go about changing it. And
Well, Franklin Roosevelt changed it. Frankly, I think that if things get bad enough, enough people will get out in the streets and say, we want change and we will have change. And I think that, frankly, we're getting damn close to that.
The generation coming up are seeing this.
Yep.
My oldest son, he's 17 and he's in a senior year in high school, and all of his classmates and everybody in this area, we're not a rich area. Yeah. We can't afford to spend thousands of dollars to send our kids to school.
Yeah.
But if we educate them now, maybe they can help their kids.
Yep, you're right.
And I just simply agree that in the United States of America, we've got to figure out something.
Yeah, we do. We need a national GI Bill without the GIs. We need to go back to Jefferson
exactly
and
right.
Franklin's idea.
I served my country for 5 years, and, you know, it didn't benefit my children.
Yeah, that's tragic. Jay, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story. Ziggy in Hawaii. Hey, Ziggy, what's up?
Hey, what's up? Hey, I've been, watching your program a lot, but upon the education thing, I'm a Vietnam vet, and I went to college in the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
But the regular education system in America is gone way downhill. I mean, they have charter schools now for the rich because, you know, the private schools teach you more.
Well, the private schools don't—they can cherry pick their students. So the consequence of that is that the public schools get dumped into them, the learning disabled kids, which makes it more difficult for the public schools, makes it more expensive for the public schools, makes it easier to vilify the public schools, and makes people wary of them. And this is the damage that's been done ever since Bill Bennett was Secretary of Education in the Reagan administration. I mean, my wife says that's going to say on my tombstone, it all started with Reagan. It did.
Well,
you know, this downhill slide.
Stuff goes downhill, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, you know, the student loan, okay, like, you know, I believe that the education should be, schools should be public, free.
Yes.
And I got a good example of that. Cuba, they export doctors all over.
It's their main export. We export gasoline. It's our number one export. Cuba's number one export is doctors. Tell me there's not something wrong with that picture.
And Cuba has free college.
That's right. Free everything. Free, yes, absolutely. Excellent point. Thank you. Nadia in South Eldon, Illinois. Nadia, we have just a minute to the break. A quick one?
Yes, Tom. Thank you so much for getting me active. I became a precinct committeeman, and now I'm running for Kane County Board.
Oh, is that great?
My website is nadiaforkanecountyboard.com. I sure could use some financial support.
Okay.
And it's because of you, Tom. I really appreciate all you do,
and I
am all for free college.
Thank you. Let's plug that website one more time. N-A-D-I-A, Nadia? Is that right?
That's right.
And Nadia,
yes.
For F-O-R. Is that right?
Kane County.
King
yeah.
County Board?
K-A-N-E.
Oh, I'm sorry, say that again.
Kane County. K-A-N-E.
Oh, Kane. I'm sorry, I was thinking King. So it's Kane, like K-A-N-E, County Board?
Board.
.com. .com. Okay, Nadia for Kane, K-A-N-E, County Board.com. Hopefully a few people will check it out, Nadia. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for getting active and being part of the solution instead of the problem. Good on you. God bless you. Good luck. I wish you the very best. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
What's it going to take for us to, as a country, say, you know, we really shouldn't be one of the last developed countries in the world educationally? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, speaking of education, this over at Republic Report today, just here's the headline. The headline says it all. You can read it at republicreport.org. Billionaires behind push in North Carolina to transfer $40 million of taxpayer money to private schools. Billionaires behind push, right? Hey, we can make some money off this. What do these people think? They're just doing things to be good for society and nice to each other and make it a nice country and a good place to live. Come on, that's silly. Somebody's got to make a buck. More specifically, we've got to make a buck. Right. Speaking of which, J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, went to the House of Representatives yesterday to get his butt kissed. And the chief butt kisser was the head of the banking committee, Spencer Baucus, Republican. Guess who his second largest campaign donor for his entire life is? J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon. What's amazing to me, though, is that it's $100,000 that J.P. Morgan Chase gave Spencer Baucus to basically make sure that when Baucus shows up, that when Dimon shows up before the committee, he wasn't even sworn in. His testimony was not even under oath. Right? That's a decision that Baucus makes. What astounds me is how cheap it is to buy a congressman. I mean, you know, Jamie Dimon had to give like, wasn't it $4.5 million to the New York City Police Department back when Occupy Wall Street was being busted up? My recollection is that it was $4.5 million that J.P. Morgan Chase gave to the Policeman's Benevolent Fund or whatever it's called. And, you know, the upshot of that, of course, is that all of a sudden you saw the police starting getting really serious with the Occupy protesters. So serious that yesterday the United Nations sent a letter to Secretary of State Clinton saying, we're a little worried about how you guys, how your police are treating your protesters. Wait a minute, we only thought that happened in China. I mean, you watch our media, you think it only happens in Burma, right? That only happens in Iran. No. It happens here. To the point that the United Nations is upset about it. It's amazing. Just amazing. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, I read something in one of these City College newspapers that says for every dollar we put in education, we get $4.50 back in tax revenues. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good return.
Yeah, of course. People who are educated make more throughout the course of their lives, and they obviously pay more taxes on it. Excellent.
Yeah,
excellent.
I'm a working class kid from working class background. I went got my teaching credential. Of course, I stacked on with my wife, who got her PhD, about $80,000 in student loan.
Oh.
And we can't refinance that like another loan,
right.
like our home. Why? That's you know.
The reason why you can't refinance it is because in their infinite wisdom, Congress during the Bush administration passed a law that said that student loans cannot be discharged during bankruptcy. So not only do the banksters who used to write the student loans, not only did they have their student loans guaranteed by the federal government, but you can't discharge it through bankruptcy. And if you were to roll that over into, say, you know, your home equity or put it on a credit card or anything else, if you could turn it into any other kind of loan and you went bankrupt, it could be done away with. And that's why they're keeping it the way it is.
It's obscene because, you know, I'm paying like 8%, Bob. That's unbelievable.
That is absolutely obscene.
And also, they have some kind of deal where you could, another thing that's happened is from the 1970s is the administration's gone up three times. You guys got deans and deanlets making 500, a million. That's the big thing. It's been the cost increase.
Well,
they hire part-time professors because I think they're trying to break unions.
Yeah.
They don't want to have people tenured. They don't want to have people in security.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't disagree. I'm not convinced that paying the CEO of the university $1 million is what's driving the tuition increases. I think it's more that the private sector is in there. There's competition for the high dollar, although you'd think there'd be competition for the low dollar. The bottom line, though, Jeff, and thanks for the call, is I think we need to go back to having a publicly funded educational system. I mean, what happened to that? This was Thomas Jefferson's idea, then it became Abraham Lincoln's idea, and now it's like anathema. Jay in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, afternoon, Tom. Love your show. Hey, two quick comments. The first one, I fully agree with free higher education. I think it needs to be mandatory, but I think we should take it to the next level and pay for it by taxing businesses, because the businesses are what gets the advantage of the electorate. I mean, you go to college to get a job, the business benefits from that educated workforce.
You're absolutely right. Who benefits from an educated workforce? The businesses. You're absolutely right. And this is well said, Jay. Really well said. And it is part of our infrastructure. It's our intellectual infrastructure that is used by business. Kelly in Minneapolis, listening to KTNF 950 AM. Hey, Kelly, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to call with regard to your comments about the cost of education, higher education.
Yeah.
My wife and I are we're self-employed, and we have a small business that we have a lot of people from around the world that come and stay with us. And when I sit down and talk to these people, it's amazing how many of these other developed countries have tuition rates for higher education in the $1,000 to $2,000 a year range. It's crazy. They hear about the cost of education here, and they just can't believe it.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of these countries, you know, Germany, I believe Israel does this. There's many countries that say, we'll make you a deal. Switzerland, we'll make you a deal. You give us a year after high school. And it doesn't have to be in the military. It just has to be something that serves the country. So it could be working in a nonprofit. It could be volunteering in a school or a hospital. It could be whatever, you know, or in the military. You give us a year of your life, and we will give you an education. And the young people get that rite of passage, which is actually biologically, psychologically, sociologically needed, you know, that transition from childhood to adulthood. They get that experience. They get out of their house, and they get to see the country or the world. And they get a free education, and the country benefits from it as well. And
absolutely,
you know.
And I was just to say, our own personal experience is that we got very fortunate, or I should say, our daughter did. She got accepted. She's in her third year at Harvard. Well, you know, they obviously have a huge endowment, and she's you know going to get out of school with a very small amount of debt. She's very fortunate that way, and we're fortunate in that. We wouldn't be able to put her through a school like that or even come close. And on the flip side, our son, who just graduated high school just a couple weeks ago, we live in Minnesota, and Minnesota has a reciprocity agreement with the province of Manitoba. He is going to be going to the University of Winnipeg. Yesterday, we signed him up for a full year of college tuition, a full year, including his health insurance, which has, you know, is very comprehensive. It's $3,600.
Wow.
Because he's paying Canadian resident tuition as a Minnesota resident, or
wow.
As a resident of Minnesota, because of the tuition or the reciprocity agreement.
Right.
So he's going up there and paying, you know, $8,000 to $10,000 less per year for a quality education at a quality school than he would be otherwise around here.
Right.
So
the Canadians get it. I mean, you know, the rest of the world gets it. I mean, the developed world, you know, it's education is free or damn close to it. Kelly, thank you very much for the call. Or certainly affordable. Bob in York, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add some thoughts to your college funding discussion. I have two kids that are 23 and 26 now, so I've just gone through this ringer pretty recently.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody likes to make a lot of noise about how there's so much financial aid available for anybody to get a college education. And the truth of that matter is there's plenty of funds available as long as you're willing, when the funds run out, to take money from Chase or Wells Fargo and guarantee the loan, you know, co-sign for it at really high interest rates, and then everybody comes out strapped for the next 30 years on this.
No, I know it well. I'm the co-signer on several student loans.
Yeah.
I know it well.
Yeah, my kids both are in that boat, and everybody that I know in this generation is coming out of school with huge debt loads.
Yep.
You know, which 6 months after they're out of school, they're expected to start making payments on it.
Yep.
And that's, you know, everybody wants to talk about.
Did you see the story in the paper last week about this guy who makes like $18,000 a year as a gardener, and his son was a really, really good student and got a partial scholarship to college but had to get student loans. Ended up, you know, he was like, I think in his second or third year of college, was $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 in debt, whatever it was, and he got hit by a car and killed. And now the student loan collectors are coming after the grieving father who has lost his son, who only makes $18,000 a year as a gardener. He's like a first-generation immigrant. and they're calling him, you know, all through the night, won't let him sleep, following him around, hounding him, saying, you can't discharge this in bankruptcy. You are going to pay this. We're going to, you know, you're going to have to sell your house. You're going to have to, we're going to bankrupt you because your kid died with student loans that you co-signed.
I actually experienced a little bit of that myself. My son, right before he graduated, broke his arm real bad and ended up winding up and needing surgery. And so he couldn't start working 6 months after school.
Right.
And they started to hound him, and then they came after me.
Wow. Wow. This is an insane system. Thank you, Bob. That only benefits people as rich as Mitt Romney. That's it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And frankly, in America, you shouldn't have to be one of Romney's sons with their $100 million endowment. You shouldn't have to be one of them to have a good college education. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Ellen, you got to get me a tease to read about the wonderful, beautiful German cities.
I used to live
in Germany. I love the German cities. I disagree
with
your
Europe
policy.
I'm going to be there this week.
Really? You're going to be in Germany?
Quick.
Yeah, just a quick trip through. Okay. Are you on your way
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, what's up in the world?
Okay, well, first of all, as you know, President Obama invoked executive privilege ahead of the Holder contempt vote, and then today the House Oversight Committee, and that actually used to be run by Congressman Bob Ney, is now run by Daryl Issa. You're going to get Congressman Ney tomorrow, so he can give you the inner workings on that. But they voted 23-17. Mr. Boehner said that he is going to bring it to the House floor, the contempt, next week.
Wow. And given that the Tea Party has so much influence in the House of Representatives, they will vote to hold Holder in contempt. But
as we like to say, as a 10-pound Robin Fat, absolutely.
Is that the end of it? What happens?
When it will then go, it will go to the prosecuting attorney in the District of Washington. I forget which federal district it is.
Yeah.
And just like under Bush, the prosecuting attorney will do nothing.
Oh, so Congress held some of Bush's people in contempt. I know they were going to hold Karl Rove in contempt.
Yes. So what happens is then it goes to the local prosecutor, and then the prosecutor does nothing because it's political.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Right. So that's what's going to – it will die there.
Interesting.
But now they can go home and they can do their thing. Actually –
and they can brag to their constituents.
Right. The letter was written to Chairman Issa from Deputy Attorney General James Cole, and he said, you know, basically we've tried to negotiate. We've tried to give you documents. Elijah Cummings, Democrat of Maryland, said that he went after ISA for going on national television to tag the nation's chief law enforcement officer a liar, he said, and accused Cummings accused ISA of making highly inflammatory personal attacks against Holder. And he said, you accused Holder of a cover-up for protecting documents he was prohibited by law from producing.
Well, are you familiar with the conspiracy theory here? I mean, these guys actually think that that these two black guys, the president and the attorney general, conspired to sell guns to a bunch of brown people down in Mexico so that they would bring those guns back to the United States and kill so many white people that the white people would start saying, we need to do something about all these guns. Do away with the Second Amendment. Let's end the Second Amendment. Take our guns. So that then these black people who are running the White House could start rounding up those white people and put them in the FEMA camps.
You cannot make this stuff up.
No,
they're fantasies. I understand.
You're on Fox News. These guys believe this stuff. It's astounding. We've got a clip from a congressman basically laying this out. Anyhow, back to you.
So that is pretty much Congressman Ney said quite a bit, but I'm going to let him tell you what he thinks of this tomorrow because
okay,
it's pretty
great. I look forward to that.
Okay, the Muslim hearings today.
Muslim hearings?
Well, Representative Peter King actually had some Muslims up there today, he's been doing these continuous things really relating to Islamophobia, and just to push my niece Lizzie Ratner's work.
Uh-huh.
She actually edited the Current Nation a whole issue on Islamophobia.
Wow, good.
So, yeah, she's done some great work with that. Okay, so Chairman King said he had little sympathy for an argument by the ACLU that was signed by 40 organizations and interest groups that characterized the hearings as an affront to our fundamental rights and values and having undermined the nation's commitment to religious liberty. He said, and he made the panel today consist of community leaders that were Muslim doctors, writers, et cetera, who, you know, obviously are concerned. Then he supports what they've done, what the FBI has done in terms of the Muslim community, by saying, well, the FBI went to Italian social clubs, they went to Irish bars on the west side of Manhattan, and now they're looking for the Russian mob. They go to Brighton Beach and Coney Island. That's good police work, is what King said.
Hmm.
I mean, it's
well, there is a small element of truth to that.
Well, I understand, but he's using this to go through the entire Muslim community. I mean, that's really what he's doing. And
in other words, instead of the FBI going to the restaurants that they knew were the cash-only Italian restaurants where the mob was making some bucks,
exactly.
They say, hey, anybody whose name ends with an I or an O, we're going to...
Exactly.
Yeah, got it. And the FBI didn't do that. They were not... Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I've never done that. Okay. Now, it's interesting. Laura Richardson, Democrat from California, she asked all these Muslim witnesses, well, what is your expertise in terrorism? Have you had any knowledge of this? Have you had any knowledge of law enforcement? Because, of course, Congressman King wanted to bring up Muslims to say, well, there are some Muslims that are equally concerned. But then she wanted to know, well, have any of you guys had any experience in terrorism?
Are you or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party of the United States?
Right, okay.
It's a variation on that, wasn't it?
So today, the Romney campaign had a conference call with a bunch of reporters, of which we were on it. And as you know, Governor Romney is tomorrow making a speech in Florida at the National Association of Latino and Elected and Appointed Officials. And they would not answer the question whether they thought illegal immigration was good or bad for the economy. They were asked to limit their questions to the economy, and that's when they asked that question, because they didn't want to deal with any of the immigration issues. And by the way, Marco Rubio today on television said that, you know, he's very open to things. He denied that he wasn't going to be on this. Of course, Romney denied it. I'm still going with, I bet you it's Marco Rubio as the vice presidential candidate.
You think so? You think Romney's going to take a chance?
And I got to tell you, I had dinner last night with some very RNC types, Republican National Committee, and they're telling me, well, yes, Romney has to do this to appeal to the party, but he's really a moderate. I said, give him a break.
Right, yeah. I think that that's, you know, a pretty solid analysis. Give me a break. Okay, what to expect when you're electing. That's coming up next. This Talk Radio News Service brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. Learn more online at germany.info. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Remember, was it earlier in the week or the weekend or late last week? It was sometime in the last 4 or 5 days, Mitt Romney was in Wisconsin. He was hanging out with Paul Ryan. They were giving speeches together, and Romney was hugging him, and they were talking. They were just so happy. Why does Mitt Romney look so happy to be hanging out with Congressman Paul Ryan? Well, probably because Congressman Paul Ryan wants to give Mitt Romney a tax break worth millions of dollars. And if Paul Ryan wanted to give you some sort of tax break, then you'd probably be hugging him too. But he doesn't want to just... He doesn't want to, you know, Paul Ryan doesn't want to give you a tax break. In fact, he wants to raise your taxes in order to pay for the tax break that he wants to give to Mitt Romney. Here's how it's working. The Congressional Joint Economic Committee just released a new study on the Paul Ryan Republican budget, which passed out of the House earlier this year, thanks to the support of nearly every single Republican. And what they found is that millionaires like Mitt Romney would get a 12.5% tax break. Now, consider that. Mitt Romney is worth $250 million and makes tens of millions of dollars a year sitting on his butt waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. Excuse me, the carried interest checks to arrive. Maximum 15% income tax. That comes out to a pretty hefty million-dollar, multi-million-dollar tax break courtesy of his buddy Paul Ryan if this budget goes through. On top of the sizable $77,000 tax break that Romney got by writing off his wife's horse last year as a tax deduction. No, I'm not making this up. Unfortunately for the rest of us who aren't worth $260 million, and it would be $360 million if he hadn't given $100 million to his kids through one of these fancy, you know, get your lawyers to put it together, trust things where he doesn't have to pay taxes on. Anyhow, and we don't have dressage horses to write off as a tax deduction. Unfortunately for the rest of us, the Ryan plan that Romney so loves that's going to cut his taxes will actually raise our taxes. As the Washington Post pointed out, quote, this is from the Washington Post, quote, the tax reform plan that House Republicans have advanced would sharply cut taxes for the wealthiest Americans and could leave middle-class households facing much larger tax bills. Here's how it all breaks down. The Ryan plan creates just two tax brackets, drastically lowering the top income tax rate down to 25%. Right now it's at 33, I think. It was 36 during the Clinton administration. And creating a second income tax rate of 10% for working people, including poor working people who right now are paying nothing in income taxes. Now, that might look like a good deal for everyone, but Paul Ryan also eliminates a lot of tax deductions used by working people, so the end result actually works out to a tax increase for low- and middle-income Americans. These are the facts. Paul Ryan budget, which, again, virtually every Republican in the House of Representatives voted for. Now, the Senate, the Democrats in the Senate are blocking this thing, but this was passed by the House of Representatives. John Boehner brought down his gavel. Eric Cantor, yes, we did it. Passed it. Every Republican. It raises taxes on working people. I think we've found the unwritten exemption or exception to multimillionaire and K Street lobbyist Grover Norquist's pledge. You know, his no new taxes pledge. Actually, it should be slightly rewritten. Tax increases are okay when they hit working people. They're not okay when they hit rich people like Mitt Romney, Grover Norquist, or the Koch brothers. But the Paul Ryan plan, as well as Mitt Romney's tax plan, which also includes a tax cut for billionaires, also explains why so many millionaires and billionaires, and this is the really important part, like Foster Fries, the Koch brothers, Shelley Adelson, why they're willing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to get Romney and the Republicans elected in November. These are not actual campaign contributions. When Shelley Adelson says he's going to give $100 million to the Romney, it's not a contribution. When the Koch brothers pour money into millions of dollars into Scott White, it's not a contribution. It's an investment. This is a very simple premise, really. If I'm a billionaire like Shelley Adelson or a Wall Street guy who earns $1 billion a year, and there are dozens of them who literally bring home that much money every year, over $1 billion. And if I know that Mitt Romney and the Republicans win, I'll get a 12% tax cut. Then why wouldn't I invest in their cause? I mean, 12%. 12% on $1 billion of income, that's $120 million. So Adelson has already hinted that he's willing to invest $100 billion in getting Romney and the Republicans elected. So if his investment works out and his income next year is $1 billion, then he'll show a net profit of $20 million on his investment in Romney and the Republicans. That's a damn good return on investment. Shelley Adelson, he's actually worth $25 billion. So he ends up profiting a lot more. What Citizens United did is it turned our politics into a gambling ring where the super rich can pick out a candidate or a racehorse, invest or bet huge amounts of money into making sure that their racehorse wins, knowing that if they bet wisely, if they invested wisely, then they'll get a tax break that's even bigger than their initial investment. And in the case of Mitt Romney, he can collect a nice fat tax break on the horse, too. As for us working Americans who are facing a tax increase thanks to Paul Ryan and can't afford to buy a politician like Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell, the only way we can fight back is to overturn Citizens United and get the money out of politics. We have to put an end to this billionaire's gambling ring or investment scheme that's taken over our democracy. I told you earlier, you know, Spencer Baucus, yesterday, the head of the Republican head of the House Banking Committee, saying to Jamie Dimon, "Sir, will you please bend over so I can kiss your rear end?" And Jamie Dimon saying, "Well, of course, sir." I mean, this Republican after Republican after Republican. "Me too, sir." MoveToAmend.org is the website where you can get involved with this. MoveToAmend.org is working to get money out of politics, because what has happened here is that we have the best politicians money can buy, and it is the result of one thing and one thing only, and that is 5 out of the 9 people who sit 2 blocks away from me at the Supreme Court building in black robes and think of themselves as the kings of America. Now, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court has the power to strike down laws passed by Congress. And certainly nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court has the power to create law, to make doctrine. It doesn't exist. Read Article 3 of the Constitution. Article 3 of the Constitution not only says in Article 3, Section 2, in fact, let me give you the exact language, that the judicial branch, I mean, here it is. The Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, and they're the final appeals court, right? You and I have a dispute, or, you know, me and my store or something. Somebody has to have the final say. Okay, so the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Not only is the Supreme Court, according to the Constitution, not the most important and powerful branch of government, they're the least. They're subordinate to Congress. That's why it's Article 3. Article 2 is the presidency. Article 1 is Congress. Congress is closest to the people. The Supreme Court is not even elected. And yet this Supreme Court, the John Roberts Supreme Court, John Roberts, Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas, Sam Alito, Justice Kennedy, what these guys have said, what these 5 men have said, is that money isn't property. It isn't stuff you stick in your pocket or put in your bank account. It's speech, didn't you know? And the Constitution, when it talks about people and rights, it's not just talking about human beings, it's talking about corporations too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We've got to push back on this. And it was so great to have Brian Schweitzer, the governor of Montana, on yesterday talking about this. End corporate personhood. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where despair is not an option. Get out there and get active. Adam in Kona, Hawaii. I've been to Kona. Hey, how you doing, Adam? What's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, Kona, Hawaii. I'm here.
There is a beautiful waterfall in or just outside Kona. Am I remembering that right?
Well, there are some waterfalls a little ways out. It's kind of on the other side, the more rainy side of the island. But we have everything. We have waterfalls. We have volcanoes. We have snow, even. We can have snowball fights when you come and visit us here.
Wow.
On the top of Mauna Kea, which is 13,500 feet above sea level.
Amazing. It's been a few years since Louise and I were there, but it's... in fact, I wrote a book there called The Greatest Spiritual Secret of the Century. But anyhow, what's up?
Well, I represent a group called the 11th Amendment Movement, or TEAM for short.
Did you call about this yesterday?
One of the people who follow us was speaking to you about it, and he called me. He said, hey, he spoke to Tom about it, and you seemed interested.
And I don't know very much about it. I mean, I read the 11th Amendment, and I'm not able to quite make sense of it. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah. Our group filed an amicus curiae brief in the
front of the court brief,
alongside the 22 states. They filed a brief in support of Montana, and John McCain and Sheldon Whitehouse filed their brief. Our group also filed a brief in support of Montana.
And now, this is Montana's Supreme Court saying that the Citizens United decision is wrong and that they should have the right to limit political money coming from corporations in their state.
Well, that's the argument that most of the other briefs took,
right,
that money does corrupt.
Right. There's a genuine harm.
Facts have changed, and that the court should reject it on the so-called merits, what's called the merits of the case.
Right.
Our argument says simply, the 11th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits a private party, which includes an individual or now a corporation, as you well know, corporations are persons. A private party cannot sue a sovereign state in a federal court, except in very specific circumstances. And those circumstances are not at all present in this Montana case. And the 11th Amendment argument says that the Supreme Court must refuse jurisdiction. They must deny what's called the petition for certiorari,
right,
that they're only considering whether to hear the case. They should deny
it. Which is a fancy word for standing.
Then Montana wins immediately, that their state Supreme Court law limiting corporate spending in elections will stand. They win right away without ever making any other arguments as to whether money corrupts or any of all of that.
Right.
That's the 11th Amendment argument.
Yeah. Now, the 11th Amendment, for the people who are listening or watching and don't know what we're talking about, it's one sentence long. It was proposed in 1794. This would have been during the George Washington administration, and ratified in 1795. However, the amendment was not proclaimed until 1798, which was during the John Adams administration because of delays in certifying the ratification. One sentence long, it says the judicial power, but this was the founders. This wasn't something that came after the Civil War like 13, 14, and 15. It says the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. So the judicial power of the United States, in other words, the federal courts, may not can't extend to any suit in law or equity brought against any state by another state or by citizens or subjects of a foreign state. How is this is the but is not the situation in Montana where the state Supreme Court of Montana said we still have the right to regulate money in politics, is that not Montana versus the United States Supreme Court, not Montana versus a private party?
The original wording of the 11th Amendment from, as you say, 1794 and then 1795 was when it was originally ratified, and then the other history that you put out. The original wording, they wrote it to pertain to the actual case back in 1795, a case called Chisholm versus Georgia. And they put it that way because in that case it was somebody from another state, South Carolina, who was suing the state of Georgia. But in over 200 years of later Supreme Court decisions that further narrowed that original wording, the situation is that Supreme Court decisions have narrowed it, that it includes all private parties, individuals or corporations, from either outside of the state or within the state, residents of the own state or corporations within the state, to they cannot sue a sovereign state. This is not what the state.
No, but I got that. But is this not the federal government? In the Montana case, their Supreme Court ruled in a way that is opposite of what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled. So is this not the Montana Supreme Court versus the U.S. Supreme Court?
It is two corporations in Montana.
No, the original case. Yeah,
that's right. They sued the Montana Attorney General, the Montana State Supreme Court, and they brought it through the state court system.
Oh, so you're saying the original case should never have been granted cert?
Well, it hasn't been granted cert yet at the Supreme Court. You see, The recourse for private corporations is only in the state court, not
right.
the federal court. They exhausted all of their remedies in the state court system. Now they are appealing to the Supreme Court to help them out, to help the corporations out.
Right.
But the 11th Amendment says
they cannot
sue in a federal court.
I get it. Whereas with Citizens United, the situation that you had was there, you know, there wasn't a state government involved. It was the federal law that was involved. It was the McCain-Feingold Act that was involved.
Right. And as you, I think you just pointed out, that there is something called the Exceptions Clause. You were speaking of that a little earlier? Is that correct?
I don't recall. How does that relate to this?
Section 2. So Congress can make actions.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Adam, we're out of time. Thank you for the call. Brilliant. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I have said it before. I will say it again. We have the smartest listeners and viewers on earth. Thank you. We'll be back with more right after this. That would be the good, the bad, and the very, very tattooously ugly. Tattooous? Yeah, whatever. The good. By the way, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good. C-SPAN caller from Massachusetts. On Monday, Florida Republican Congressman Alan West was on C-SPAN taking calls from viewers. One viewer called in and asked Congressman West to name a few communists in Congress, a reference to remarks West had recently made about communists in the Democratic Party. Well, West had a hard time coming up with names. Instead, he went on a diatribe about how the term progressive is actually the new name for communist, and that it's just how communism has been rebranded and marketed in society today. First of all, West needs to refresh himself on the definitions of progressive and communist. Dictionary might be useful. And second, he couldn't come up with the name of one so-called communist in Congress. Kudos to the C-SPAN caller for holding West accountable for his absurd and outrageous remarks. The bad. Senator Marco Rubio, the Republican from Florida, in an interview with Christianity Today, published yesterday, Rubio repeated his opposition to same-sex marriage, to marriage equality, saying that the Bible opposes it, and so do all faiths that he's experienced. Rubio also suggested that science shouldn't accept less than ideal family structures. Rubio said the debate is about what society should tolerate and what society should allow our laws to be. The ideal, not the only way, but certainly the ideal situation to raise children to become productive and healthy humans is in a home with a father and mother married to each other. End quote. Apparently, Senator Rubio is unaware of the numerous studies that show children do just fine, sometimes even better, growing up with parents of the same sex. And the very, very ugly, the National Review. You may remember in April, the National Review fired contributor John Derbyshire because of a highly racist piece that he had written. Well, the National Review has filled that vacant contributor spot with David Yerushalayim, a known Islamophobic and white nationalist. Some of Yerushalayim's extremist statements include calling for the adherence to Islam to be illegal, and saying that there is a reason the Founding Fathers did not give women or black slaves the right to vote. Yes, that's a verbatim quote from him. So it looks like the National Review didn't learn anything from the Derbyshire incident and is going to continue to allow intolerance, hatred, and bigotry to fill its pages. And that is very, very ugly. So Adam from Hawaii, who called about the 11th Amendment, I'm going to open a couple of lines here. Give me a call back if you can. I'd like to continue this conversation. If you can give us a call at 866-745-2667, because I was talking with Shane O'Farnham. Shane is our associate producer here and actually went to law school, and which I can't claim. And he said, he pointed out to me, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says the Supreme Court shall have, in all other cases, you know, it goes through this long list of the cases where the Supreme Court has jurisdiction. Things like, you know, admiralty law and actually I've got the list. I've got the Constitution here. cases affecting ambassadors, where other public ministers and consuls, all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, controversies to which the United States shall be a party, controversies between two or more states, et cetera, et cetera. And then it says, in all of the cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exception and under such regulations as the Congress shall make, something that I had quoted a little earlier, the exception clause. And Adam Shane is suggesting, if you're still watching, and maybe not, I don't know, Shane is suggesting that you're confusing original jurisdiction with appellate jurisdiction. That the Supreme Court has appellate jurisdiction in a dispute between private parties in a state after it's passed through the Supreme Court of a state. Do I have that right, Shane? I mean, feel free to open your mic and pop in on this if you can do that. Is that possible?
I think I can.
Ah, there you are. So explain this to us.
Essentially, there's the two types of jurisdiction. Original jurisdiction is when you first bring the case. Now, if two people within the same state, if I were to sue you, Tom, and we both were
God forbid.
We're Virginia residents.
Why don't you sue Jim?
Okay. Okay. In the state of Virginia.
Right.
And I brought it in federal court. The court would say, you're kicked out. We don't have jurisdiction, original jurisdiction over your case.
Right. A state court would have to hear it because it's two people within the state.
Right. So, and the 11th Amendment says this as well. In original jurisdiction between two people or between a person in that state, you can't. But so if we were to start that in the state court and then go all the way to the top of that state, you know, all the way to the
top. So the state Supreme Court.
And well, in New York would be the Court of Appeals, the highest court of that state.
Right.
Once that court has determined it, the Supreme Court can take it if they want to. The very, you know, or they can fast track it in some cases.
Right. And that's Article 3, Section 2, where it says in all other cases.
And also the
Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction.
And the Congress can change those, you know, jurisdictions by law as well. So.
Right, except as provided by regulation of Congress.
Exactly.
And Congress has not changed that in the 230-some-odd years we've been around.
You're asking me to something I can't probably say definitively off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure that I know for a fact that if you start a case in state court and it goes all the way to the top, the Supreme Court can hear it.
Right. Yeah. So Montana may – so this remedy using the 11th Amendment that Adam is suggesting for Montana.
I think it's pretty tough.
Yeah.
Pretty tough call.
Okay, great. Shane, thanks a lot.
You got it.
Thanks for the call, Shane. calling the information. Hack in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, Hack, what's up?
Hey, how's it going? Well, Eric Holder was indeed found in contempt by the House Oversight Committee, but you know something? To be found in contempt by someone as beneath contempt as Darrell Issa, in my opinion, would be a badge of honor.
Yeah, well, I think he's the only member of Congress who actually has a criminal past. In addition to being one of the richest guys in Congress who made all his money, or much of his money, selling car alarm systems that were made in China. So
yeah, well, you know, go figure, you know, because, you know, if he were really concerned about Fast and Furious, a.k.a. Operation Wide Receiver, as it was known during the Bush administration, he would have, as far as I know, he has not subpoenaed one Bush administration official under whom the program started.
Right. And, yeah, well, that's because this is a political witch hunt. It has nothing to do with the merits of the case. He's trying to feed this bizarre conspiracy theory that Eric Holder and Barack Obama are trying to blow up the Second Amendment.
Senator John Cornyn, the Republican, from Texas, has latched on and he's joined the cry for Holder's resignation.
Sure. Well, of course, they're all going to do it. They think they've got a Bill Clinton moment, and they thought they had a Bill Clinton moment when Bill Clinton was president. And he got to, actually, they think they have a Richard Nixon moment, and they don't. Well said. Thank you very much, Hack. I appreciate the call. Adam in Hawaii, hey, thanks for calling back. And Shane, open your mic back up, and we'll have this conversation. Adam, did you hear Shane's comments?
I saw or heard, rather, that you'd like to get a little more elaboration, and that's great. And I did hear some of Shane's comments, and I think I may be able to address some of those. But if you want to wait till Shane comes on.
No, he's right. Basically, his point. Make your point in a sentence or two, Shane.
Essentially, when it comes to the 11th Amendment, you're dealing. There's a difference between original
jurisdiction.
I'm right here. Maybe in my, you know what? I'm probably not on the aux back.
Oh, okay. So he can't hear you. Can you fiddle with the pot there and make it possible that he can hear you? Da, 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 da. Because if he can't hear you, then probably our TV viewers can't hear you.
He should probably be able to hear me now.
Can you hear Shane now? Adam?
I cannot hear Shane.
Okay. Yeah, okay. All right. We can't make it work through the board. Basically, what he was saying is that original jurisdiction is different from appellate jurisdiction, that Article 3, Section 2 says basically the Supreme Court has appellate jurisdiction in all other cases. This is a case of appellate jurisdiction. The 11th Amendment doesn't take that away.
Well, it actually restores the original understanding of the states. First of all, I would ask all attorneys out there or others interested who have that legal frame to go to our website. I won't give it on the air if you don't want.
No, feel free.
Yeah, it's www.11thAmendment.
Is that 11th or ELEV? You know.
Yeah, it's 11thAmendment.org.
Okay.
And there they can read the actual briefs. Now, there are two briefs put forth. Carl Mayer authored one brief. Carl Mayer just won a case against the Justice Department that declared unconstitutional provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act that would imprison
U.S.
citizens without charges indefinitely.
Carl's a very, very good attorney. He worked on the Nike versus Caskey case.
Won the Nike versus Caskey case, right? He was on one of the briefs. On the other brief that was submitted on behalf of Essential Information, which is a Ralph Nader founded group, is Rob Hager, who has won many Supreme Court cases. We're going way back to the Karen Silkwood case, all kinds of things involving Agent Orange cases. So these, they put together these briefs, and people can read the brief. I encourage Shane to read the brief because the 11th Amendment is the first amendment after the Bill of Rights. Now, you are a student of constitutional history, I know, and admire greatly. And your listeners are perhaps, I know on the break, you say, you know, your listeners are the smartest people who call in the radio. And you are right. Yeah. They really are the most informed to all these little nuances.
Adam, we have to wrap it. I'm sorry, it's the tyranny of the clock, but thank you for the call.
We'll
be right back. Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're not going to resolve this today, but it's starting to sound like the debate about, whether the Supreme Court should have the power to knock down laws, which I argue with lawyers about all the time. We'll be back. Yeah, so what they teach you in law school could be wrong. I think what they teach in law school about original jurisdiction is wrong. I think what they teach in law school about Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad is wrong. And maybe what they teach you in law school. See, the 11th Amendment followed the Constitution, so it modified the Constitution. That's the argument that Adam is making. So we'll see. I don't know. We're going to continue to learn about this, Shano and I. Shano and me, I guess, with my English teacher is echoing in my head here. Stan in San Francisco. Hey, Stan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm a little mystified by a question that you might be able to answer. If the Supreme Court justices take an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States, and they make decisions that are contrary to the United States, who jurisdicts that violation of the oath? Is there a penalty for it? And if there isn't a penalty for it, why did they take the oath in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, I know that there's an oath for the president that's specified in the Constitution. I don't know if there's an oath specified for legislators. Do you know, Shane? Not sure.
There is. I put it up on the Internet. There is an oath that the justices have to take.
Oh, there is. Okay.
Yes.
So, and it's not tradition. It's actually constitutional.
Yes, protect and defend the Constitution.
Right. Okay. So I would submit to you that the jurisdictional body, particularly given, the outcome of Marbury versus Madison, that body would be the court itself.
to the court jurisdiction itself. Though.
Yeah, I mean, they basically put themselves above everybody else in Marbury in 1803. And, you know, when they said that they had original, 1803 was, you know, original jurisdiction, or not original jurisdiction, what's the legal doctrine of the ability to strike down laws? Anyhow, they claimed that. And then they claimed in the 1820s, and I forget the case and the date. I think it was 1825, that they had judicial supremacy as well. And so, you know, during that era, the Supreme Court basically put themselves above all other branches of government. So,
well, then my question is, if a majority of the Supreme Court judges colluded to do something that was flagrantly illegal.
Oh, actually, wait a minute. There is a provision. There is a provision at law for dealing with that, and it's called impeachment. Any of these Supreme Court judges can be impeached, and they can be impeached by Congress. So the group that would determine whether they have violated their oath or not would be the House of Representatives, and where they would hold an impeachment hearing. And then if they are impeached in the House of Representatives, there would be a trial held in the Senate. And if they are convicted, they would be removed from their office on the Supreme Court. I'm sorry it took me so long to remember that.
Then is there a possibility that instead of trying to change the law that strikes down corporate personhood, that we might try to impeach some of these judges?
No, because you will not find a member of the House of Representatives who is willing to do that. Even during the New Deal era, when the court was, you know, knocking down Roosevelt stuff that was wildly popular, both with Congress, because there's this huge Democratic majority in Congress, and with the American people. And Roosevelt was pulling his hair out because the Supreme Court was saying, no, no, the New Deal is unconstitutional. You can't have minimum wage laws. You can't have child labor laws, et cetera, et cetera. Roosevelt had to come up with this idea in 1936-37 that using Article 3, Section 2, that he took away the right to vote on the Supreme Court for anybody 70 years old or older, and they would still stay on the court, but all the 70-year-olds or 70-plus-year-olds would end up having one vote, and that was half the court at that time. And then new members would be brought onto the court to make up for it, to bring it up to 9 voting members. And so the court would have become like, you know, 12 or 13 people, and his so-called court packing scheme. And he probably would have gotten away with it if he had really pushed it hard, but there was so much blowback that he backed off. But even in the face of that, I mean, this constitutional crisis that was brought about, and the Supreme Court then, as a consequence of that, backed down and started, you know, agreeing with him on his cases, although, you know, Scalia is clearly saying that he thinks that the court was ruling wrongly in those cases, particularly in 41 or 42, maybe it was 45, but it was in the early 40s when the Supreme Court just, you know, basically said the Commerce Clause is, you know, can be used for New Deal legislation, is the bottom line. Scalia wants to undo that. But the court, you know, figured out and started going along. But even then, I mean, even back in the 30s, when you had the President of the United States taking on the Supreme Court, to the best of my knowledge, nobody in the House of Representatives was holding impeachment hearings.
So they do ultimately have ultimate power then.
Well, you know, if they committed a crime, I'm guessing if a member of the Supreme Court, you know, murdered one of their law clerks, I doubt the Bill Clinton kind of problem would be raised, because the body is theoretically not as political as the presidency. But, you know, if a member of the Supreme Court committed some really heinous crime and refused to resign or refused to submit to the authority of the police, then certainly there would be an impeachment. But I think that the concept of impeaching people because you disagree with their politics is not a popular concept. It's basically the reason why Scott Walker won, in addition to $40 million from billionaires, won the challenge to remove him from office. You know, he won that because so many people who disliked him intensely didn't think that you should be removing somebody from office because you disagree with what they're doing in office. You remove them from office because they're corrupt. You remove them from office because they've done, you know, horrible things, but not for their politics. Their politics are not what you should do. So I don't think that that's going to happen. I just, you know, as much as I would love to think it, Stan, thanks for the call. I can't imagine it happening. So coming up next, the Supreme Court ruling on Obamacare could come as early as Monday. I'll have a conversation with Congressman Alan Grayson or former Congressman Alan Grace for his thoughts on this. Plus, my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science Rock, scared grasshoppers leaving their mark on the earth, and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, get out there and get active. Democracy is not a spectator sport. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.